You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to Mom and Dad Are Fighting, Slate's parenting podcast for Thursday, February 8th, the Secret Twins edition. I'm Gabriel Roth. I'm an editor at Slate, and I am the father of Leo, who is 3.5, and also of Eliza, who is 7 years old.
I'm Rebecca Lavoie, a journalist and podcaster in New Hampshire, and I am mom in absentia to Henry, who is 16, Teddy, who is 15, and my stepdaughter Lily, who is 17.
And I'm Carvel Wallace, a writer and podcaster in Oakland, California, and I am the father to Georgia, who is 12, and Ezra, who is 14.
Today on our show, we have a question from a mother who is scared to send her son to camp for fear that he will encounter sexual abuse. We also have a question from another mom whose solution to the problem of dirty stuffed toys is potentially coming back to bite her in the ass in fascinating ways. Plus, as always, we'll have triumphs, we'll have fails, we'll have things to recommend to you. On Slate Plus, we will take a third question. So many great questions this week. This one about the eternal problem of teenage boys and hygiene. Triumphs and fails. Carvel, why don't you tell us, have you triumphed or have you failed?
I've done both, and today I'm going to tell you about something that I think it feels to me like a failure. It happened just this morning. I was driving Georgia to school. We were making small talk, and somehow, I don't remember how this came up, the discussion of dress coding came up, which is a thing. To be dress coded at her school is to be cited by a staff member for failure to follow a series of dress code situations. And like, and so I've known about this for a while, and that this happens, and it's not something that Georgia typically runs into because she doesn't, like, she pretty much wears jeans and a hoodie every single day. But she initially told this story about a friend of hers who was dress coded and how she was frustrated because there's these three eighth grade girls who dress in violation of the code all the time and they never get dress coded. And Georgia was wondering if race had something to do with it because the three girls are like white and her friend is black. And so we were having a small discussion about that. And then she started unfolding to me more about the dress code. And then she explained that like the details of it, which I sort of knew but had forgotten, were that girls can't wear like anything that shows their belly button, and they can't wear like spaghetti straps, and the shorts have to be longer than your like where your fingers are when you put your hands to your thighs. And Georgia was like, and I have long arms, and that's, you know, that's, but then she was like, but then boys play basketball with their shirts off all the time and no one says anything. And I got so mad. Like, I got so pissed off. And I just was like, maybe it's because, like, I had a deadline last night and didn't get a lot of sleep, but I was just like, what the fuck is that? What the fuck is that? That makes no sense. She was like, yeah, I know that. It's fucked up. I was like, no, it really, and we were literally cursing. Like, this is, like, middle school. And I was like, what? Like, what is that? Like, what? You know? And she was like, yeah, it's, like, it's really messed up. And I was like, God, I swear to God, man, I just was so mad. And she got out of the car and whatever, and I just was, like, still fuming over it. And it just – I don't even know where to begin. It begins at the beginning, but it's a fail of our society. You know, it's like a fail of everything. It's like, what is that? What is that? And the way that kids are dress-coded at this school just depends entirely upon an individual teacher choosing to cite you in a moment because they have a personal opinion about what you're wearing. And the enforcement is all over the board, and this – even the double standard itself, boys and girls, and she was like, there really aren't even dress codes for boys. Like, there's none. None exist. And I just was, like, so mad, and I'm still mad about it. And so it's, I don't know if it's a personal fail, but it's a fail for our society, and I'm fucking pissed off about it.
Totally. There was a great editorial in my local high school's newspaper, The Talon, a couple of years ago, written by a girl who I believe at the time was a junior, about this exact thing. And she did not hold back, and it was awesome because also at my local school, dress code is sexist. Teachers will say it's to keep other students from being, quote, distracted in their learning environment because of what, you know, you, always girls, are wearing, and it's total bullshit. It really pisses me off. It is exactly the opposite of the message that, you know, we're trying to impart at home. Like, you know, it's totally bullshit, and it is a societal failure. I 100% agree with you.
And the problem is the inegalitarianism, is that right? The problem is that it's applied very differently to boys and to girls.
Yeah, it's applied. There literally is no dress code for boys. So like, she was when she, I mean, because I remember now that we started talking, we were talking about hats and like why hats are banned in school, and we were going back and forth and talking about like I was in a feisty mood. I was like, that's bullshit. That's arbitrary. Like, what the hell? She was like, well, hats are disrespectful. I was like, but why? Why society? I was that guy this morning. You know,
this is one of the ones where you can react a little too closely to the adolescent brain.
Yeah, exactly. And but then when she got to the part about boys playing, taking off their shirts to play basketball, I was like, what is that? Like, what is that? How can you say girls can't show a belly button, but boys can be shirtless at school? Like, what is that? Someone explain to me what that is. You know, it's just so, yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah. Rebecca, what about you? Triumph or fail?
I've got a little baby triumph, and I believe we have a little audio file so that you guys can hear about it. Teddy, where are we?
We are in our laundry room.
Why are we in our laundry room?
I want you to wash my sweatshirt.
Why?
Because it's nasty. Because I wear it all the time.
So you want me to wash this one thing?
Yes.
So that you can wear it when?
Tomorrow.
Okay. So here's what we're going to do. Pick up that sweatshirt. Put it in that machine. Go above the machine. Grab one of those Tide Pods.
And eat it.
Don't eat it. Stick it in the machine. Close the door. Turn the machine on. Put it on normal casual. Hit start. So yeah, baby triumph.
Hell
I
of
taught
a triumph.
Teddy. I did not fall into that trap of
you
yes, I will
it.
Wash your dirty sweatshirt.
Yeah, that's really good.
I taught a boy to fish.
I remember being at my cousin's apartment when I was a teenager. I was staying there for a while, and I was like, oh, I need to do some laundry. And she's like, oh, yeah, the washer dryer's in the garage. So I went and put them in the garage. And I was like, I can't figure out how to work this. Can you come show me how? And she didn't know how to work it. And we were like 15, and a bunch of our friends were around. And she was so embarrassed. Like, it was a – she still brings it up occasionally. So now you have saved Teddy from being that kid who doesn't know how to work the washer dryer in his own house.
Yeah, this actually has happened with Henry, too. And it came in handy because when we were dropping him off to move him in his D.C. housing, you know, they have to do their own laundry. And he knows how to do it. But it turns out, like, a lot of the kids didn't. And so this morning, you know, today's a snow day. Teddy's at home today because it's a snow day. And he's like, oh, it's a good opportunity to wash my disgusting sweatshirt, which I wear every single day. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing it. This is it. We're taking a stand. So that's how that happened. And I'm certain I'll probably end up washing it again myself a few more times. But, you know, he's at least had his start.
Great work. I have a fail. And this is a fail that falls into the category of, like, when you have to judge whether a kid is sick and shouldn't do an activity or not. And you just don't have enough information to make that judgment. Over this weekend, my wife was away. She was out of town, so it was me and the kids for the whole weekend. And I had this whole plan for Saturday afternoon because Eliza got invited to a birthday party that was in Coney Island, which is like an hour on the subway. And, you know, there's only one of me. And so I was going to take Leo on the subway with us. And then we were going to go to the aquarium. And there's another dad who has a kid in each of the two classes, and his kids were going, so me and him were going to take the little ones to the aquarium while the big ones were at the birthday party, and it was very carefully worked out. And it was going to take up like our entire afternoon. Like, I didn't have to think about what we were going to do on Saturday because we had this whole schlep and this whole business, and it was going to be a thing. It was going to be tiring, but it was going to be an adventure. And we wake up, and she's sort of sniffly, but she's fine. And then it's like time to start getting ready to go. And I get everybody dressed and I start like doing the last stuff, making sure everybody has peed. And she says, Dad, I don't feel well. I don't want to go. And it's really clear that this could well be just laziness, like that it could well be just natural resistance and disinclination to go outside, especially when it's like not very nice outside. But she's been a little sick before and like, are we going to do it? And maybe I'm going to bring her and she's going to be the one who is like feverish and roomy and like sneezing all over all the other kids and everyone's going to be mad at me for that. And I said, are you really sure you really don't want to go? And you know this means you'll miss the birthday party and you won't get cake and you won't get like a goodie bag to take home and you won't see all your friends. And she's like, yeah, I really don't feel well. I really think I should just stay home and lie on the couch and read. So we stay home. And we stay home the whole day. Like, it's me and the two kids and we're inside the apartment the entire day. And of course, like 20 minutes after we were meant to leave on the subway, she's like jumping up and down on the couch and like getting her brother worked up and like running around chasing him and tickling him. And I'm like, what the hell? You're supposed to be like sick and sitting on the couch and recuperating. She's like, oh yeah, sorry. And it was the wrong call. And what can you do? And I thought, well, at least like most of the punishment goes to her. It was a tough day because of being cooped up inside. But I thought at least she's the one who really gets punished because she misses the birthday party. And then yesterday I picked her up from school and she was like, guess what? The person who had the birthday party brought in a special goodie bag just for me because I missed her party. And she's like going through on the bus and showing me all the, like, here's the candy ring and here's the bouncy ball and here's the flashing light. And so it really worked out really well for her and set up some terrible incentives for future birthday parties. So I made the wrong call and I am mad about it. That's it.
Gabe, my mother-in-law told me an amazing story about my wonderful husband when he was like in second or third grade, that he pulled the same thing. The little kid directly across the street was having a birthday party and he said, I don't feel well, I can't go. And his mother said, you know, you have to go, you know, you got to go over and just at least try. She thought he was just, you know, BSing. So he comes back about 15 minutes later with like the older brother of the kid and he's carrying the gift and he's like, oh, Mom, I told you I wasn't feeling well. And the older brother here, he brought me home. And she said, yeah, but you can't bring the gift back. Like, that belongs to the birthday boy. And apparently what he was doing was just trying to keep the gift. Just like lying about being sick.
Nice.
So yeah, I don't think that's what your daughter was doing. I'm not accusing her of that, but no. I guess this is not a super uncommon thing to do.
No, it's weird. You would think that like, who doesn't want to go to a birthday party? But there are kids, and I think I was probably one of them too, for whom like just going out of the house is just a pain in the ass. And if I stay inside, it's a lot better. And look what kind of adults we grow up to be. Wonderful.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Most of you listening right now are probably multitasking. Yep, while you're listening, you're probably also driving, cleaning, exercising, or maybe even grocery shopping. But if you're not some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you can be doing right now: getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy, and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So, just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average, 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Time now to do the business. As always, if you have a question that you would like us to answer, you can leave us a message at 424-255-7833 or email us at momanddad@slate.com. Also, I would like to let you know about another of Slate's great podcasts. Have you ever checked out Slate Money, a weekly roundup of the most important stories from the world of business and finance? It features Felix Salmon, Slate's columnist Jordan Weissman, and political risk consultant Anna Szymanski. They talk the week's financial news from Uber to Herbalife to hedge funds. Check out Slate Money every Saturday morning, wherever you get your podcasts. On Slate Plus today, we're going to answer a whole nother question from a whole nother listener. If you want to hear that segment and get an ad-free version of this and all your other favorite Slate podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. It's a great way to help support the show. Just $35 your first year. In return, you get extended ad-free versions of this show, other great Slate shows, and a ton of other great benefits. So if you want to help us out, go to slate.com/momanddadplus and join Slate Plus today. This question came to us over email. The question is from Terry. It's being read for us by Slate Science intern Alex Barish.
Dear Mom and Dad Are Fighting, I am the mom of twin boys age 9. My husband and I have been planning to send them to sleepaway camp for 2 weeks this summer, but as the registration date approaches, I'm feeling increasingly anxious about having them out of my sights for that time period. And here's the main reason. I'm worried about child sexual abuse. I was not a victim of such abuse, but I know many people who were molested as children, and it has affected them for the rest of their lives. I grew up in a Catholic parish where it was later found that one of the priests was sexually abusing the altar boys. I've looked into the statistics on child sexual abuse, and although the estimates vary, the numbers are shocking. Yet I don't want my boys to miss out on an experience that would most likely help them learn teamwork, love of the outdoors, and leave them with an increased confidence and independence. I admit I am an anxious person at baseline, but I've tried hard to not smother my kids or make them feel the world is a scary place. They're happy, active boys and get along pretty well. They adapt to new situations easily, and I wouldn't expect for them to have a problem with 2 weeks away from home. My question is this: how do I prepare them to respond if someone attempts to touch them in a way that makes them uncomfortable? How do I educate them about good and bad touch without giving them more information than they're ready to hear? At this point, they know babies are made from egg and sperm, but we haven't gotten to the description of intercourse. I don't want them to arrive at camp feeling wary of the adults around, but I figure since Carvel and Rebecca have older kids, they might have addressed this already and have some good tips or resources. Thanks so much, Terry.
First off, I would say, if I knew you personally and you asked me this question, to you take a leap, send your kids to camp. The benefits of summer camp, you know, my kids have spent 2 weeks of summer, Teddy especially still at 15, going to a wonderful YMCA-run summer camp for boys on a lake. And it is, as you suspect, a transformational experience. They come home, especially after the first year. They've had that set of independence. They make friends outside of their immediate circle. Camps, for the most part, I can't speak to the specific camp because I don't know what it is that you're thinking about, you know, sending your kids to. But for the most part, you know, all the camps that I considered for my kids and the one they ended up going to are exceedingly well run, and the kids are really well supervised, but have just enough of a sense of freedom to really get a sense of that sort of independence and, you know, that feeling of sort of being out in the world, away from home. It can really, really be a wonderful experience for kids. I understand your fear, and my instinct is to tell you what I always thought about when my kids were little, is that bad things happen to kids a lot. Sexual abuse is shockingly common, as you probably know from the reading you've been doing, and it can happen in all kinds of situations. It can happen at a sleepover. It can happen with going over to a friend's house after school. It can happen with a relative, a babysitter, a family member. It shouldn't stop you from having your kid enjoy the experiences that you know would benefit them. And when it comes to communicating that, and I think your kids at 9 are old enough to really have a real conversation using real language about how to say no, about how to go and tell and understand what predators do and predator behavior and the kinds of things that a kid is likely to hear if they're abused, such as don't tell anyone or I will hurt your mom or dad. Like, you have to have these real conversations with your kids. You have to use the real words in describing their body parts. You can't just say bathing suit area, private parts, bum. You have to be specific when you say, you know, don't let someone touch you on the penis. Don't let someone touch you on the butt. If touching makes you uncomfortable, under your clothes, you know, say something, walk away, find another adult, tell them what happened, and just be comfortable knowing that they can probably handle that conversation and they're probably maybe not going to take it as, you know, seriously as you do when you have it with them. But if you have it frequently enough, if you sort of weave it in to conversations in a way that doesn't feel like an epic come to Jesus thing that they just want to forget ever happened, if you make it sort of a part of your discourse, if you ask them questions about their agency and their body, and you let them talk about those things at home regularly enough, they do develop a sense of ownership of their privacy, of their body, of boundaries. And, you know, I can speak for my kids when I tell you that, like, neither one of them has ever come home and said that something specifically made me uncomfortable. But they have told me that people have made them uncomfortable, that they've gotten vibes, that they've felt, you know, I wouldn't, you know, when I was in this situation, I just made sure, you know, I always want to bring friends with me or whatever. And we talk about it, and we talk it through because it's really important. But I think it's a mistake to just wrap them in bubble wrap and never send them out into the world because of your anxiety around this issue. And I can't speak to a specific resource, but perhaps that's something we could maybe check into and post some links on the Facebook page around a great book or something. Carvel, do you have any ideas around that?
Yeah, no, I think exactly what you said is right. And there is a good resource. The name's escape. Oh, rain.org, R-A-I-N-N, which I forgot what it stands for, but and also the Department of Justice, I know, whatever, forget their branding, but the Department of Justice actually has a pretty good page about talking to children about childhood sexual abuse. And one of the things that everyone does recommend is starting the conversations when the kids are young, using the specific names of body parts, making sure kids know that certain parts of the body are private, making sure kids know that it's okay to say no. And probably one of the biggest things is like making sure, talking to your kids a lot about secrets, because secrets are the way, the kind of like vehicle by which these situations, you know, predators use what they think kids understand about secrets as a way to buy themselves space. And I think overall, in all of parenting, one of the most important things that I feel like we have learned is that you have to constantly behave and interact with your kids in a way that allows them to feel like they can talk to you if something is serious. And that's something that I know Joe and I keep in the back of our minds all the time, because, you know, it's partially for stuff like this. Partially, I've said this before, like, we know that as they go into adolescence and their interactions with the world start to kind of like outweigh their daily interactions with us, we know that there'll be situations that they'll encounter where they will have to make a decision between staying in what is potentially an unsafe situation or calling for backup from us. And if we haven't done years and years of establishing that they can talk to us if something is serious and that we prioritize their safety over everything, that's over like yelling at them, that's over, you know, like punishing them, that's, you know, if we have made sure to establish that, then our bet is that in those situations, they're more inclined to reach out for help if they feel like they need it. And I think that's a big part of what this experience is about, too. You know, I agree with what Rebecca said, especially about the bubble wrap thing, because this can happen anywhere. And I mean, this is my own personal experience. It happened to me in places where I think people didn't expect it. And it's terrifying and it's horrible for parents to think about that. And yet the logical conclusion is that you can't keep your child from every situation in which something like this is likely to happen. And I don't think it's more likely to happen at camp than it is to happen in other places, or not much more, not so much more so that you can't send them to camp. And I think that, and I also think that just thinking practically, tactically about the situation, how do you explain to two kids, 9-year-old kids that want to go to a summer camp, that everyone, that their friends are going to, that they're excited about? How do you explain that you're not going to send them without having this conversation? So the reality is you have to have this conversation anyway. This is a conversation that should be had. And our squeamishness about it as parents doesn't serve us or our kids. We have to be upfront about it. And I also would advise, if you were my friend, that you can send your kids to camp. You know, if to whatever extent you can be a part of the camp experience, at least to be a face or name that is known. I don't know if that's going to the, like, and it sounds like you're a pretty active parent, and so you'll probably do this anyway, but you're going to the orientation, meeting the staff, making sure they know you and you know them. That's all helpful. I mean, at the very least, it's helpful for you to feel like it isn't this unwieldy black hole over which you have no control, which I think is really the kind of underneath fear that we have as parents when we send our kids to camp. I think that's helpful to do. But I think, you know, if you are reasonably sure that this is an okay situation, you should send them. The other thing I would, you know, I always think about talking to other people, and I would talk to other parents too whose kids have gone to camp years prior, if you ever were to do that. You know, again, just to set yourself at ease about what the positive aspects of this are. We sent both of our kids to sleepaway camp. Georgia, we sent to sleepaway camp when she was very young. She really wanted to go. And she was actually like, because her birthday is in August, she was actually like just under the age, but they decided to allow her go because the counselors knew her and Ezra was there. And they knew that Georgia kind of sort of like was mature anyway. And just the other day, I was flipping through old pictures and I saw the picture of when we sent her. And God, she was such a little thing. And it of course, it was terrifying on some level to send your kids into what you know is... Yeah, again, it's a place you have no control, and that really is what it's about, and that's terrifying. But that camp for us was a part of a community of parents that we knew and people that we knew, and that we knew families who'd been sending their kids there for decades. And so we were able to have some measure of comfort. So I would say also to whatever extent you can build those connections would be helpful to you as well as to your kids.
Yeah, I think that's the really interesting thing about this letter is the degree to which the letter writer is just fixated on summer camp as the place where sexual abuse happens, when we all know that sexual abuse happens all over the place, and happens in the family and happens in schools and happens with friends and happens at a birthday party and can happen wherever. And it makes me think that what's actually frightening about summer camp is that, like, it's sending your kids away from home for 2 fucking weeks. They're 9-year-old boys. That's really scary. Like, when my kids go away for 2 weeks, I'm going to be really nervous about it, and I'm going to wonder all kinds of things that might happen. It seems like you've maybe fixated on sexual abuse as, like, the bad thing that happens, and maybe it would help to broaden your ideas about what kinds of bad things can happen to them at summer camp, and to broaden your ideas about what kinds of places sexual abuse can happen to them, because in a way the world is scarier than you think, but then in a way the world is less scary than you think, because most kids go away to summer camp and have a great summer and do not get molested or sexually abused. In terms of things that you might say to your kids about that specific fear, Carvel and Rebecca have said most of what I wanted to say. The phrase that I've heard that you should use is like secret touches as opposed to good touches and bad touches, because it might be that, like, look, I'm tickling you. That's a good touch. But if you have to keep it a secret, then it's a secret touch. And that's something that you need to tell your mom about or tell some other grown up about. And then the other thing that I've heard is that it's important to remember that you shouldn't let anybody else make you touch them, that it's not just about grown-ups touching kids, that often sexual abusers tell the kids to touch the abuser's genitals. And parents' warnings often sort of leave that out, maybe because it's too gross or scary or whatever. So there's a lot of disturbing stuff that you, again, have to tell your kid about in a sort of straightforward way. And maybe it would be helpful to try to talk about it as straightforwardly as you can and with as little, with a, as much plain and straightforward language and as little sort of panic as you can possibly muster. But hopefully it helps to remember that what you're actually scared about is them growing up and going away, as well as the dangers of adult sexual predators in the world. Maybe that helps, or maybe it doesn't. But good luck, and I hope your kids have a great time at camp.
Can I just add one thing, Gabe?
Yeah.
You know, one of the things that she said was she talked about her anxiety, right? And I grew up in a house with a very anxious mother. And, you know, thinking about what you said, Carvel, about secrets, I didn't tell my mom anything growing up, and bad things happened to me too. And I never said a word. I still haven't to this day because my mother has like a lot of anxiety, and I know that it will frame a lot of conversations we have for the rest of my life if it comes up, because that anxiety is something that I think kids learn to avoid triggering. They learn to avoid not, you know, saying things or doing things that they know will send their anxious parent into a state of anxiety, because that state of anxiety can often mean consequences. It can mean punishment. It can mean sheltering them from things they want to do. So kids do respond to that. And, you know, when I had kids, I think I felt some of those feelings starting to creep in when my kids were babies. And I just kept thinking to myself over and over and over again, you know, do I want to have kids that I pass along this kind of anxiety to, where they feel like they then don't want to do things or try things or talk about secrets and so forth? And I think that, you know, I figured out I succeeded in that when Henry recently, I don't want to say too recently, but, you know, in the last year or so, went to a high school party and the next day called me and told me that he'd been drinking at the high school party and wasn't feeling well. And he didn't know what to do. And he was like, I know that we need to have a bigger conversation, but right now I just need to know what to do because I'm really sick. And I was like, I feel like I did my job because...
And you were like, hair of the dog.
Yeah. Well, I was like, grilled cheese sandwich, frankly. but anyway, you know, it's like that phone call meant so much to me. And yeah, it triggered some really meaningful and I think really productive conversations about choices and responsibility and all that stuff. Stuff that was timely because it was happening around him in the moment. And even like the kids who make the best choices, like Carvel said, find themselves in situations where they then, you know, are facing things that they didn't know they'd be facing. But the fact that he called me, I don't think it would have happened if I hadn't made the conscious choice to try to overcome those feelings of anxiety and letting my kids' activities and the choices I made for them be guided by those feelings of anxiety. So I'm not saying it's wrong to be anxious. And I understand that that's something that you have a limited amount of control over. But just think about what you are teaching when you infuse your decision making and the things your kids are allowed to do, and they're colored by the anxiety that you sort of overtly express around them. It's something that I think is worth thinking about.
I agree. And it might be worth looking to talk to a therapist or to talk to somebody about the anxiety separate from the particular question of sexual abuse.
Yeah, I agree.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Time now for another question. This one is from an anonymous mom who called us on the phone at 424-255-7833.
Hi, Mom and Dad are fighting. This is an anonymous mom, and you'll know why I'm anonymous after I ask my question. This question is in follow-up to the Binky episode last week, which I totally loved. My kids are at an age now where it's been a long time since we had Binkies, but we had a strategy for getting rid of them that worked really well until now. When they were 6 months old, we took away the Binky and we replaced it with a comfort object, a stuffed animal. But I was terrified that we would lose the comfort object and then be in a world of hurt. So we bought a secret twin of each of their stuffed animal loveys and rotated them over time. So every time the special friend got too dirty or too disgusting, we would just swap it out for a fresh one and secretly wash it. And this was great because they both aged at the same rate and we had a backup in case of emergencies. The problem is that now my kids are old enough that if they found out that their special friend had a secret twin, it would be a major soap opera-style betrayal reveal. So I don't know what to do. Do I keep this a secret forever? Do I tell them now and let them have both of the loveys because they're old enough to understand that sometimes your teddy has to get washed? Any advice you have would be greatly appreciated. But again, love the show. Thanks so much. Keep up the great work. Bye.
I mean... Let them know that, I mean, it's not going to, I don't think you need to be anonymous about this. I don't think it's that big a deal. I mean, I think I think this is actually a really good strategy. Our kids had only the one lovey for each of them. And yeah, I mean, it was rough. That's a brutal situation to be in for a period of years, because then every time something goes haywire with one, now all of a sudden you're in this, like, you know, 17 hours of hell while you get everything reorganized. So it's nice to have another one. But I think it's fine. I think let the twins reunite. Tell them that they're long lost twins. They were twins in the womb. They were separated at birth. And now they're together. It's a beautiful thing. It's just wonderful. And now when one is out, the other one is to play with, and they play with the other one. You know, as your kids age, I mean, you can also explain that we did that because we needed to. Because sometimes one of them gets dirty and disgusting and covered in, like, pasta juice or whatever, and we need to wash it. And so there's another one. So, I mean, I personally wouldn't – I do think it does create a problem to have, like, twin stuffies, because now it's like – now we have attachment issues with two things instead of one. So it is doubling your trouble, but you're there now. You can't, there's no unringing that bell. So I would think that, you know, if it's, if you think they're going to find out, then you might as well just, as the PR people say, get ahead of the story.
What I love about the question is I have to remain anonymous because I have just pulled off this brilliant parenting coup, and I wouldn't want anyone to know that right from the very beginning of my kid's childhood, I was so on top of things that I had this marvelous solution to the washing the stuffy problem. I think the real question here is, do you whip out the backup stuffy like for comic effect? Do you, like, is this like an awesome candid camera style prank that you play on your children? I think you probably shouldn't, but I would be very, very tempted to do that. The one other thing is, I bet they already know. Like, kids know about their stuffies, and this one has a little mark over here, and sometimes it's, like, scuffed, and sometimes it's not scuffed, or the thread is coming loose, but it's not coming loose, but it is coming loose. Something's going on. They don't know exactly what it is, and they would be surprised to learn that there was this sort of stuffy switcheroo going on. But I think it might, if you show them the two stuffies, it might actually resolve something that has been quietly gnawing away at them from the inside for a long time. And that might be a reason to do it. What do you think, Rebecca?
I totally disagree
with both of you guys. I have to say, like, I am really, like, not on board with what either one of you have to say on this. I think if your kids are still at the age where they will feel horribly betrayed by this incredibly pragmatic and loving strategy you've put into place, it's not time to reveal the secret yet. Just don't reveal it. Keep it hidden. I don't see any upside in having them feel potentially betrayed at all. It's like, let them learn it on the streets, just like they learn about Santa Claus not being real. You know, I feel like I was really lucky. Henry's comfort item was one of those Carter's waffle blankets, which came in 8-packs, and he always knew there was a pile of them, and so, like, we were able to, like, you know, have one in his stroller and the other 7 in the laundry all the time. But, like, I know that it isn't always the case. My best friend Amy, her daughter had a horse named Fatchy that was discontinued by Gund, and they had to, like, search on eBay for, like, 6 months when something happened to that damn horse. So I know it's a real thing. I'm not discounting the realness of it, which is why I don't think I would do the reveal until they get older and get to a point where it wouldn't be a devastation. I don't know. Unless you're, like, really bad at hiding stuff. Come on. How hard can it be to hide, like, a little stuffed animal? Come on. I don't know. I disagree with you guys on this one. Sorry.
No.
How old are these kids again?
We found out. We got follow up from the caller. How old, Ben? Remind us. How old were the children?
Producer Ben here in the booth. I texted Anonymous Mom, and she replied to say that, hi, they are 9 and 6, but intensely practical kids. Both asked so many tough questions about Santa Claus by age 5 that we had to tell them the truth. Similar for Easter Bunny, Tooth Fairy. Also, I forgot to mention my call that when they were little, I would tell them I used mommy magic to give their lovies instant dry showers to clean them in emergency situations. So the lie runs deep.
Oh, man. Come on.
Yeah, this is a tangled web we weave type situation.
Yeah, this person has painted themselves into multiple corners.
It's all catching up with you.
It's all catching up. I think it's time to wipe the slate clean. I really do. I think you're in too deep. It's 9 and 6. You're through the looking glass at this point. And you can't, you know what I mean? I think the only way to save yourself is to blow this whole thing up. At 9 and 6, they should be fine knowing that there are multiple stuffies, and that's the way this operates, and that's part of what makes parenting a logistical, you know, magic thing that we do, and we're always thinking. I love, maybe this is just my own ego, but I love pulling back the curtain on my parenting stuff for my kids so that they know that I'm actually working here. Like, I'm not just sitting around, you know,
arbitrary,
like, just being their dad. Like I'm doing something. Yeah. I'm trying to do a thing, you know, and this comes up a lot. Like, sometimes I'll be, like, doing something. Georgia will have an anxiety or a fear or something, and I'll start to, like, work, do my thing, you know. I'll start to set up the thing and ask the questions and get the feedback and reflect to her, and then Ezra will burst in the room and be like, Dad, why are you doing that? Blah, blah, blah. You're just lying to her. And I'll be like, Ezra, I'm doing a thing right now. I'm parenting. just take notes. Like, there's a system here.
The thing where the older kid comes in and busts you doing a thing on the younger kid happens every single time.
Right,
I'm always,
right.
I'll be in the middle of some complicated thing of trying to get Leo to like put on his shoes. And I'll be like, I'll be dealing with the tantrum and dealing with the behavior and also trying to move him forward down the road towards yeah. putting on his shoes. And it's a very intense kind of psychological project that I'm working on. And then Eliza will come along and be like, Leo, I'll give you $1 if you'll put on your shoes now.
He's like,
no, no, that's not how this works.
I had him right where I wanted him.
Oh, yeah. And the whole thing has exploded. Yeah, no. It's so terrible.
You're revealing how much like our kids are like our bosses, right? Because what you described, Carvel, and like I'm doing a thing, here's my thinking yeah. here. It's sort of like what you do at work when you're anticipating like the questions about like why you made a certain decision. So you send the email and you're like, here's what I'm going to be doing. And for some background, here's what I was thinking.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
I decided
exactly
right. to do it.
Totally. The thing, okay, yeah. the one thing that does seem potentially troublesome about exposing the twin Stuffy's ruse is this. These kids, when a kid attaches to a Stuffy, the Stuffy is like magically alive in their mind, even though they know that it's actually just an object, right? I remember being
sure.
a kid and having an involved relationship with a teddy bear, even though I was not confused as to whether the teddy bear was really alive or not, right? And if you say like, okay, this object to which you have attached all of these feelings and have this whole relationship that feels like a relationship with the living thing outside of yourself, even as you know it isn't. If you say, look how much this teddy bear is only an object. Look at this. There's another identical one. And some of the love that you have been putting into the teddy bear, you were putting into another teddy bear. The love that you think you've put into this one object, you've put into two objects. That might have like broken my brain in some way. Like it would have been a really like confounding revelation for me. So that seems like the downside.
They're 9 and 6, though. I mean, I think if
I slept with that teddy bear until I were 12.
If you,
I was 12 years old when I gave up that teddy bear.
If they were 3 and they were still wrestling with like the nature of like physical reality or something, yes, this would be akin to like revealing that there's a glitch in the Matrix. It would blow their little minds. But they're 9 and 6. I feel like at this point, they already know Santa Claus is a ruse. They already know the Easter Bunny is a ruse. Hopefully they don't believe this thing about mommy magic. I feel like these kids are ready. I mean, I don't know that you have to reveal it, but at the very least, I would go so far as to say you don't have to fear anymore the revelation should come about.
All right. Great question. Really like this question. Really want to know what happens. Get back to us, Secret Anonymous Mom with the magnificent strategy with the Stuffies.
Our bodies come in different shapes and sizes, so doesn't it make sense that our weight loss plans should too? That's the beauty of Noom. They build a personal plan that factors in dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs so your plan works for you. Noom doesn't restrict or shame when you want to treat yourself. Their flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. You don't have to give up carbs or anything. And with their daily lessons, you can learn something new about your food choices every day. After just a few days of using the app, I learned how to recognize cues for overeating and how to choose the right foods to feel full. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's Noom.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold.
Time for recommendations. Rebecca, do you have a recommendation?
I do, and I apologize for the self-promotional nature of this recommendation in advance, but I feel like Carvel opened the door for this a few weeks ago, so I'm just going to do it too.
Wow.
If you want to get to know one of my kids a little bit, my son Henry, before he left for his DC adventures, was a guest on my silly podcast about HGTV. He watches an episode of Flea Market Flip with me, where moms and sons compete on teams against each other to turn trash into less trashy trash and sell it at a flea market. The show is called HGTV and Me. It's really an episode in which Henry plays a starring role, and he's very dry and very funny and very Henry. And if you've ever been curious to hear a little bit more of what he sounds like, you can check out that episode of HGTV and Me. It's called Flea Market Flip, Trash Treasure, and a Good Morning America Host. That's what it's called.
Nice. And we will put a link to that episode on our show page and our Facebook page, which, by the way, is facebook.com/group/momanddadarefighting. I'm going to recommend a movie that many of you have probably seen that's a popular animated movie from the well-known animation studio Pixar, but which is maybe not one of the ones that's in high rotation in a lot of houses with kids. It's not one of the Cars movies, which I watched the first one the other week, and it was just terrible. But we watched Ratatouille on Saturday instead of going to this birthday party. Ratatouille is so good, man. Wow. There are no songs in Ratatouille. There is no, like, it doesn't have any of the bullshit. Both of my kids from 7 to 3 and a half were, like, engaged with it and invested in the story and thought it was funny and thought it was scary but not too scary. And, like, the dad doesn't die. I was sure that the dad was going to die and was, like, making excuses for the dad dying. But then he doesn't die in the end. The three of us, all of us really got a ton out of it. Ratatouille by Pixar. It's great. Carvel, what about you?
I'm going to recommend an app that was super popular in like 2012. And then we recently re-downloaded it and got back on it. It's Draw Something, the app from Zynga, which was like went crazy popular for like 4 months in the summer of like 2012 and then fell off the face of the earth. But the app is an interactive game app where you draw something. That's it. You get suggestions. You get to choose from three things that you want to draw. And then it's like a puppy, a dog, like a spaceship. And then you just draw it. And you get a palette of colors, and you get sort of pens of different sizes, and you can erase, and then you just draw stuff, and then you send it to your partner, and they try to guess what it is that you're drawing. And so they get to see you drawing it, not in real time, but sort of a sped up sort of video of like your images appearing on the screen, and then they do the same for you, and then when you guess right, you get points, and they get points, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just a simple, fun game that that we were really into back in the day, or I was, and then my kids were a little young for it, although they used to watch me play it and we'd like talk about how to draw stuff. And it weirdly reopened drawing in our house. Now I'm drawing stuff, just doodling. And I don't know, it's just like drawing is the one thing that I never felt like I was any good at. And now like it's just it's cool to just be able to like reaccess that part of my mind. And the kids love like teasing me about how we draw stuff, and their stuff is actually pretty good. And so, you know, every kid growing up goes through that phase where they learn to draw something. You know, you learn to draw a spaceship, you learn to draw like a horse, you learn to draw like and you're so excited and you just draw it everywhere and you can't wait. Well, this game is sort of like a great version of that, and because of the colors and because it's digital, your stuff always ends up looking kind of cool. And so I'm recommending Draw Something.
Awesome.
Carvel, I just sent you an invite to a game on Draw Something, an app I also love very, very much. And the way that my kids play that game is they try to draw the most complicated thing where they put the clue in to what the thing is at the very end. So you have to watch like super elaborate video. But
when they get older, I love it. When people get older, then the game can get even more interesting because then you get to do like conceptual stuff and like wordplay and stuff like that.
Nice. And that's our show. If you have a question that you would like us to address, you can call us at 424-255-7833. You can tell us what you thought of the show on facebook.com/momanddadarefighting. Our show is produced by Benjamin Frisch. For Carvel Wallace and Rebecca Lavoie, I'm Gabriel Roth. We will see you next week.
Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+. On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough. This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.